from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, economist, European Union advisor, and president of the Foundation on Economic Trends, Jeremy Rifkin, will join us in studio for the hour ahead. And we'll discuss his most recent book, The Third Industrial Revolution, which explores how internet technology and renewable energy are merging to create another industrial revolution that will alter the ways we work and live. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In his most recent book, economist and author Jeremy Rifkin, author of such books as The Hydrogen Economy and The End of Work, predicts the evolution of energy production and distribution from fossil fuels to more centralized renewable energies, which he believes will transform the global economy. His newest book is The Third Industrial Revolution, How Lateral Power is Transforming Energy and Changing the World. Jeremy Rifkin is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends and an advisor to the European Union. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Welcome. Glad to have you back.
Nice to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Well, I want to get into this book with you, but before we do that, I know you've been advising Chancellor Merkel and you've been advising the European Union, so let's advise us about what we think is going to happen economically. I mean, it just seems like the fear of contagion has led to the real possibility of default where Greece is concerned, and yet the Germans are pumping money in. And how do you see the future?
Well, let me start with an anecdote. I think that what's happening in the European Union is part of what's happening in the whole world. And I'll share an anecdote. I've been advising Chancellor Merkel since she came into office. When she first came into office, she asked me to come to Berlin to address the question, how do we grow the German economy in the 21st century? And, of course, at that time, Germany was the leading exporting nation in the world and now advise with China. So it's a big power. When I got there, the first question I asked the chancellor is how do you grow the German economy or the European economy or the world economy in the last stages of an energy era? What I think we're missing the real crisis, and to understand the real crisis, to understand what's going on in Europe right now, we had two events in the last 3 years which changed the game for the United States, Europe, and the world. The first event was July 2008, and that's when oil hit $147 a barrel on world markets, you recall. And when that happened, prices went through the roof for everything, food products, pharmaceuticals, construction materials, because the entire civilization is made out of fossil fuels. So when oil hit $147 a barrel, people stopped buying. Purchasing power shut down, and the whole global economy collapsed that month. What I'm suggesting is that was the economic earthquake, the collapse of the financial market 60 days later, and now the government debt crisis, that's the aftershock. And until we get to the crisis, we won't be able to address the problems facing Europe and the U.S. and the countries I advise in the EU and the EU. That's what I'm saying to them.
Germany's reduced its they're about 20% renewable energy. Why can't we get there?
Well, that's kind of the key, isn't it? Yeah, that's the key. And they're leading the way. They are laying out this Third Industrial Revolution infrastructure plan. They're way ahead on their targets. Watch Germany, because that's the model for the 21st century as far as I can see. But the situation we're in now is that this is an end game. We really hit peak globalization based on fossil fuels and industrial technologies. And the reason is something called peak oil per capita, which is a little different than peak oil production. That was reached way back in 1979 at the height of the auto age. Had we distributed all the oil we had at that point, crude oil, to everyone on the planet, that's the most each person could have. We found more crude oil since then, but population rose quicker. So if we distributed all the crude oil we have now to 6.8 billion people, there's less to go around. So when China and India started growing at an 8, 10, 14% growth rate and pushed a third of the human race into the game, the demand pressure on crude oil was too great. And, of course, that's what led to the collapse in July 2008. What I'm suggesting is that every time we try to regrow this economy, Europe, America, Asia, at the same rate we were growing before July 2008, the same thing's going to happen. The price of oil is going to go up. All the other goods and services made from or moved by oil are going to go up. purchasing power will stall, the economy will collapse. And that's what's happening this morning. You remember in 2009, the economy was dead. So oil was 30 a barrel. Nothing was moving. In 2010 and 2011, we started to replenish inventory around the world. All of a sudden, oil shoots back up over 100 a barrel. Prices are going up for everything else. Purchasing power is going down, and we're heading toward a second collapse. So my read on this for Europe and America and the world is that we are in these four-year cycles now. Every time we try to regrow the engine and turn it on, we'll have a growth spurt, prices will go up, and then collapse. And we're going to be in this wild gyration of growth and collapse, I think, for the next 25 or 30 years. So the question really is, what do we do?
Well, you call it an end game. You say fossil fuel addiction has to end because it can't be sustained, sunset of an oil era and all that, price peaking and global warming, obviously. Yet people are saying drill. We got to drill. We haven't found all the oil resources that are there. This is what we're hearing from many people in our political system.
I smile because the Petroleum Institute did a study, which I have in the book. And of course, they're the industry association. And what they found is if we open up all the potential oil reserves for drilling, the Gulf of Mexico, the East and West Coast, the Rocky Mountains, the Alaska areas, if we open it all up, the most oil we can get out of it is maybe another 10% in the next 20 years, which is infinitesimally small in a global market. It's meaningless. But I think it's denial, and I think the reason is that folks don't see a new game plan. They don't see a new vision. And so I think there's a lot of fear. And there's a lot of denial.
Well, they also get very skeptical because of something like Solyndra. And you hear particularly the right saying, look, this was an attempt to move toward renewables, and this is what happened, and we're not producing the renewables, and all the promise of green technology and green jobs, at least in this country, is not happening. You know, Germany could be the leader here, but the United States hasn't found the way. To some extent, from Jeremy Rifkin's point of view, this is – Obama doesn't have a narrative. He doesn't have a plan.
I think that's it. President Obama is certainly well-intentioned, and he wanted a green economy. And to be honest about it, he spent billions and billions of dollars on isolated projects. And he spent a lot of time visiting solar factories and battery factories and wind turbine parks. But all of his efforts were isolated. And because they were isolated, he didn't put them together in a narrative and a comprehensive roadmap and a plan that would get us to a new economic paradigm. So consequently, he really wasted billions and billions of dollars. The European Union has a plan. Maybe we could talk about it for a minute, if that makes sense. This is the EU. We started back in 2001 with the question in Brussels, how do the great economic revolutions occur? And because that gives us a roadmap. And what we realize is the great economic revolutions occur when two things happen. First, historically, when we change energy regimes. And we've had a lot of different energy regimes in history. New energy regimes make possible more complex civilizations. But then to organize them, they require communication revolutions that are agile enough to do the job. So it's when energy revolutions converge with communication revolutions, when they actually come together, we change economic history. So in the 19th century, print technology became cheap. We introduced public schools. We created a literate workforce with the communication skills to organize a very complicated coal, steam, and rail industrial revolution. And in the 20th century, centralized electricity, the telegraph and telephone, and radio and television became the communication tools to manage the complexities of an auto, oil, suburban and mass culture, mass consumer culture. What we're seeing in Europe now is the possibility of a new communication energy convergence, a third industrial revolution. And again, Germany is leading in this. The internet was a very powerful communication revolution in the last 20 years. And what's so interesting about the internet from our perspective is this communication is not centralized top down. It's distributed.
It's what you call lateral.
It's lateral power, which sounds like an oxymoron, but it's side-to-side power. It scales in a distributed, collaborative, lateral fashion. This internet communication revolution in Europe is just now, in the last 2 years, began to merge with a new energy regime, distributed energies. And when internet communications organizes distributed energies, we have a very, very powerful new economic paradigm that should grow millions of jobs and thousands of new
businesses. This is peer-to-peer democratization of energy. I mean, because you've got, like you say, the sun, the wind, hydrogen, all geothermal and so forth, and the ocean, waves. I'm wondering, though, you know, you were also at one time sounding a little bit Cassandra-ish about jobs and saying jobs were disappearing. We did a whole hour with you on that. Yeah. And also warning us, and I want to talk with you about Me Too, because I think this plays an important role in global warming that people tend to forget about, a very important, significant role to be sure. But also sending out warnings about recombinant DNA. And so people say, gee, you know, Rifkin's a pretty smart guy, but should I trust him? He said there weren't going to be any jobs. Now he's going to say, saying there are going to be jobs. Is he really a prophet? Can he really have the kind of prescience or oracular power that some people think he has?
Well, a good question. And as you know, I end the book. The last chapter is all about the present and future of work. We are ending, you know, the industrial age ended slave labor. It was just cheaper to replace the slave labor with technology. The new industrial revolution that's emerging ends mass wage labor. However, there's a 40-year slot. It's kind of a little silver lining, a period of grace, where we have to lay down this five-pillar infrastructure, which requires millions and millions and millions of jobs and thousands of businesses to lay down the infrastructure. The irony is once you lay down this smart five-pillar infrastructure, it really requires no more mass wage labor because it can run by a lot of intelligent technology. So we're in a very short interregnum, I think, between two very different periods of history. Let me lay out the five pillars, if I may, sure, just for a moment. The European Union is committed to five pillars, and together the pillars create the infrastructure. It's a mega technology, and the infrastructure is the new economic revolution. Pillar one, the EU is committed, as you know, to 20% renewable energy by 2020. That's a mandate. Every country has to do it. That means a third of the electricity has to be green in 9 years from now. Pillar two, how do we collect renewable energies? They are distributed. They're found in some proportion in every square inch of the world, the sun, the geothermal heat under the ground, the wind, garbage, hydro, the ocean tides. So pillar two is buildings. Now, buildings are the number one use of energy and the number one cause of climate change. And Michael, as you suggest, and I always mention this, the number two cause, because we never talk about it, is beef production and consumption and animal husbandry. Number three is transport. But number one is buildings. Now, we have 191 million buildings in the European Union. Homes, offices, and factories. The idea is to convert, this is the goal, to convert every single existing building to a green micro power plant over the next 40 years. So you can collect solar off the roof, wind off the sidewalls, geothermal heat under the ground, etc. The new buildings that are up now in Europe are positive power. They're actually so sophisticated architecturally, they not only can take care of all their own energy needs, but send electricity back to the grid. Pillar two jumpstarts construction. It's going to require millions of jobs, thousands of SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, working with global companies and communities to convert the entire building stock of Europe. Pillar three is the tough one, storage. Sun isn't always shining. Wind isn't always blowing. Water tables can be down for hydroelectricity. They're intermittent energies. We have to store them because here in California, for example, we put in wind turbines and we're losing 3 out of 4 kilowatts because the wind's blowing at night and we need the electricity during the day. So pillar three in the EU is storage. We like every kind of storage, batteries, flywheels, capacitors, but we've put most of the money into hydrogen. Hydrogen's the basic element of the universe. It's the lightest element. It carries other energies. And it's modular, so you can put it in your home or you can put it on a huge infrastructure. So when the sun hits your roof, if you're in a factory or home and you generate some electricity, if you don't need some of it, you put the electricity in water. Hydrogen percolates out into a tank. When the sun isn't shining, you just convert that hydrogen back to electricity.
This, again, is consistent with what you were saying in your hydrogen book.
Yeah, that was one pillar. We were just dealing with that one pillar. Pillar four is the interesting one. That's where the internet comes in to organize and manage this energy. We use off-the-shelf internet technology and convert the transmission and power lines of Europe to an energy internet that acts exactly like the internet.
These are intergrids, basically.
They're intergrids. And so when millions of people are collecting their energy on site in their buildings, storing in hydrogen, like you store media and digital, if you don't need some of that electricity during the day, you can program your software to share it across an energy internet from Ireland to the doorsteps of Russia. And then pillar five is the electric transport and logistics. Electric vehicles are out this year. Fuel cell hydrogen cars are in mass production in 2014. So you can plug in cars, buses, trucks, and trains anywhere in the infrastructure, get green electricity, and then anywhere you are along the logistics or transport routes, you can plug back in to either buy or sell your own electricity back. So these five pillars together are a mega technology.
And I can hear somebody saying, this is utopia. You know, to get this, to get these five pillars in place, to have the political will to get these five pillars in place, particularly in the United States, let alone the European Union, is a formidable mountain to climb.
It is really daunting, but the EU has started that process. Germany is already in all five pillars. As you said, they reached their 20% green electricity target last month. They're going to 35% green electricity by 2022. They just announced the phase-out of all nuclear power plants by 2022. Pillar 2, they have converted the most buildings in the world to micro-power plants in the last 5 years and created hundreds of thousands of new jobs and new businesses as well. Pillar 3, they're just putting in hydrogen storage right now across the infrastructure. Pillar 4, they're testing the smart grid in 8 major sites in Germany right now. And Pillar 5, Daimler, that created the internal combustion engine, just had their 125th anniversary, and they just announced they're moving to the fuel cell car and fuel cell infrastructure. So here's my question, I guess, for America. If Germany, one of the two great exporting powers in the world, along with China, can do this, why can't we?
Well, there is a question, and we'll put that out for our listeners. And in fact, let me invite you to join us on this program with Jeremy Rifkin if you have a response to what you've heard, or if you have questions or comments for him, you are welcome to join the program now. Our toll-free number is available to you. His new book is called The Third Industrial Revolution, How Lateral Power is Transforming Energy and Changing the World. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can call us now, again, at toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum at kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. You can also, of course, join us on our Facebook page, and Jeremy Wifkin will be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon. I'll also be at Booksmith, in San Francisco tomorrow. That's Tuesday at 7:30. This all sounds very collaborative. It sounds, you know, like you're talking about the commons and more than the traditional kind of markets and so forth. Again, the political will has to be there.
Well, you know, this is really a political and social and cultural revolution as much as an economic revolution. This, as you said, this is the democratization of energy. This is power to the people. I guess we overused it in 1968 as a phrase, but this is literal now, power to the people. The first and second industrial revolution was based on elite energies, coal, oil, gas, and uranium. So they required huge military investments to get them, huge geopolitical investments to manage them, and massive capital to organize these elite energies to get them to you and me. So all of the first and second industrial revolution scale vertically and favored centralized finance, centralized infrastructure, centralized factories, centralized logistics because of the basics of the energy. It's elite.
It's all a pyramid.
Third industrial revolution scales laterally because the energy is everywhere. And if everyone is entrepreneurial and collects their own energy, but then has to collaborate in vast energy internets that go across continents, it means that you scale laterally, and it favors a lot of millions of small players coming together in vast networks to share electricity and energy on the commons. That flattens power, not only economic power, but it also flattens political power as well. And so there are some companies and industries that are not happy with this model. And we've noticed some governments are for it and some aren't.
And some companies and industries that affect our politics more than just about anything else, really.
Yes, I think we know who they are. But we've done a few of these master plans already. There's 120 companies in the group that I chair, the Third Industrial Revolution Global Policy Group. We did San Antonio, Texas for the city. That's the seventh largest city. We did a master plan for Rome, which is rolling out now for the mayor of Rome. It's an 18 billion euro rollout. We just finished Monaco for Prince Albert and Utrecht in the Netherlands. These are complicated plans, and they favor public-private partnerships, Michael, at the local level. In other words, local government, regional government has to come together with local business and the civil society and the NGOs and lay out a comprehensive public-private partnership to move this in. And what we've noticed is this is going to move like Wi-Fi. It's nodal. As each city lays down these five pillars over a period of time, the jobs start immediately and the investments and the businesses. But then as a city or region creates their five-pillar node for this third industrial revolution, they want to connect to the next node and the next node and the next node to share the energy across a lateral plane.
Well, that's the kind of contagion the European Union needs, I would presume. This fear of contagion now with defaulting and the like. But where does nuclear energy fit into this? Or I guess it doesn't for you because of the lack of water and because of the fact that we've never known quite what to do with nuclear waste.
I think you hit the central problems. I think from a business point of view, nuclear is over. I don't spend a lot of time on it. It was pretty well over in the 80s. It's come back.
Fukushima has made it over.
Well, that's when I got a call from the chancellor. Right after Fukushima, the chancellor's office called and said, would you come to Berlin in September and join the chancellor to talk about a sustainable economy in the 21st century? And then she announced that all nuclear power plants would be offline, gone, 2022 in Germany, which means they now have to produce. The world's watching to see, can Germany pull this off? And I'm very confident they can.
But France is still staying largely nuclear, aren't they?
It is, but right under the surface, and watch the next elections, I think it's about ready to explode because there's a younger generation there that grew up on the internet, Michael, and they are used to being empowered with the idea of creating their own information, sharing it in vast social spaces and commons. And this younger generation really is not comfortable with the old centralized, top-down nuclear power a way they organize society, and the political power is centralized there as well. So I think France is going to really open up in a major way in the next year.
You also, I think, pointed out that here in the United States, we only have, 400 nuclear plants, and most of them are pretty old, I mean, in terms of maintenance.
They're very old. They're commissioning out, and they only make up 6% of the energy mix. Nuclear power plants in the whole world only make up 6% of the energy. Now, the comeback for nuclear was we are part of the solution. We're clean tech. We don't emit CO2. All right? But the problem is to have a minimum impact on climate change, nuclear power would have to be 20% of the mix, according to our scientific community, not 6% of the mix. That means you'd have to build 2,000 nuclear power plants, three every 30 days for the next 40 years to have a minimum impact. Not going to happen. Can't get rid of the nuclear waste. Uranium prices are going up. We don't have the water. 40% of all the water consumed in France every year, 40% of all the fresh water is used to cool the nuclear reactors. It comes back heated, and it's dehydrating ecosystems and affecting agriculture. So I think nuclear is really, really a technology for the 20th century. It's centralized. It's top-down. It doesn't fit the internet generation of the 21st century.
Where does coal fit into this?
Well, you know, we have lots of other fossil fuels. We have plenty of coal in the world. We have tar sands in Canada.
Then we also have the possibility of a big oil pipeline from Alberta coming down.
For the tar sands, absolutely. And we have heavy oil in Venezuela. There's lots of fossil fuels outside of crude oil, but they're dirtier. They emit more CO2. And we're already terrified because we're seeing that climate change is accelerating even quicker than our model suggested in the last report in 2007. So I think we're in a bind. On the one hand, the second industrial revolution is clearly on life support. Fossil fuels and uranium energy are never going to get cheaper. They're going to get more and more expensive. The technologies based on them are exhausted, like the internal combustion engine. And the whole infrastructure, Michael, this civilization is made out of carbon, all the construction. So it's not coming back. There's no way to regrow the U.S. or world economy based on an energy regime and technologies that have now matured. So we have to move to this third industrial revolution very, very quickly.
And again, the new book is The Third Industrial Revolution, How Lateral Power is Transforming Energy and Changing the World. Jeremy Rifkin, our guest. When we return, we'll hear from you, your calls, your emails, your web comments. Feel free to join us also on Facebook. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. In his latest book, economist and trend spotter Jeremy Rifkin predicts that the evolution of energy production and distribution from fossil fuels to more decentralized renewable energy will transform the global economy. He joins us to discuss the third industrial revolution this hour, and the subtitle is How Lateral Power is Transforming Energy, the Economy, and the World. And he'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, at Booksmith's in San Francisco tomorrow at 7:30, and we go to your calls. Let's welcome Phil as our first caller. Phil, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, there's no shortage of hydrocarbon fuels. There was a concern that the gas would be gone, and that's why the tar sands are being looked into. But there have been huge new discoveries of natural gas reserves. You know, it's better than gasoline, but it's still a hydrocarbon. For example, I understand There's a natural gas reserve just discovered off the coast of Israel, and it may have something to do with why Turkey is messing with Israel right now. And North America, the United States in particular, has large reserves of natural gas. And, you know, won't that displace, you know, green energy methods because it'll be less expensive?
I think it's a difficult challenge. Of course, shale gas is what you're referring to in fracking. And there's a lot of potential shale gas. On the other hand, it has very, very challenging environmental problems attached to it, so much so that France, which usually likes any kind of new fossil fuel or nuclear energy technology, has already banned shale gas exploration. My wife and I have a farm in Virginia near the Blue Ridge, and we're very concerned, as are people in Pennsylvania, because we're seeing groundwater contamination now from shale gas. But, you know, as I said
before,
what
happened to all that shale that was in Colorado? Remember they were going to turn that into fossil fuel somehow?
It didn't happen. It didn't happen. But, you know, this is the thing we have to understand is we can go to these other fuels, but it's going to continue to up the CO2 ante. Our scientists are telling us now we're looking at a 3 degrees Celsius rise in temperature in this century because of fossil fuels. It could go much higher. But 3 degrees puts us back to the temperature on Earth 3 million years ago. And this is what I think our listeners should hear. It's all about the water cycle. For every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature rises on this planet, the atmosphere absorbs 7% more precipitation from the ground. It just sucks it up. So that means more violent floods, longer periods of drought, and our plant and animal species cannot catch up. The ecosystems cannot adjust to a water cycle that's changing that dramatically. And that's why we're seeing very steep changes in agriculture. We're losing yields, and now we're having infrastructure damage around the world from extreme weather. So we really have to understand that we may be in the beginnings of a mass extinction event in this century. If the UN climate panel is correct, we could see upwards of a 70% die-out of all plant and animal species on Earth by the end of the century. That would be the sixth extinction event in the last 450 million years. And there's nothing that suggests that human beings, the human race, will survive this. So I think this is a critical point. I think that we need a new game plan. We have to get off carbon quickly. And interesting enough, this third industrial revolution not only allows us to do that quickly, and it can scale as quickly in the developing world, but it produces millions of jobs and thousands of new business opportunities. So not to do that, and rather to stay in the sunset energies, industries, and technologies of the past century, literally just makes no sense from either a business or a social perspective.
You still have an extraordinary number of people who don't believe global warming is even real. But here's Bill, who raises an important question. He says, what about all the waste and byproducts created in the manufacture of all of this green technology and the problems in disposing of it once its useful life is over?
Well, there's always an entropy, Bill. In the book, in the Third Industrial Revolution, I have a chapter devoted to that. You know, folks said, well, you know, should you mention it? Of course. A lot of the new technologies require rare earth materials. And while they're still in a modest supply, we could see some problems with some of the rare earth materials that are used for our various renewable energy technologies. And that means that we have to, in the next 20 or 30 years, rev up sustainable chemistry and begin to develop biological alternatives for these technologies. So this isn't a utopia. But what I suggest is this. I think my wife put it the best. She said, this isn't rocket science. We know that we have to get off fossil fuels because these energies are getting more expensive and we have climate change. So that's number one. Number two, we know we have to collect them. If they're found everywhere, the only way to collect them is your buildings and infrastructure, to convert your buildings and infrastructure into power plants. Three, we know we have to store them because they're intermittent energy, so we have to put in hydrogen to store them. Four, we have to share them because if we just each producing a little energy, it's not enough. We have to share them in an energy internet so we can create enough load to run a society. And five, we have to plug them into our transport and logistics so we can engage in commerce. If this isn't where we need to go, what would Plan B look like? I'm not sure. And this is, I think, here's what I think we've had a problem. There's a generational gap here, Michael, between the older generation of business and political leaders and a younger generation. The music companies did not understand file sharing of music. They thought it was a joke when millions of kids started file-sharing music with software. Then they tried to legislate against it, and then they went out of business. The newspapers did not get the blogosphere. Millions of people coming together in a distributed, collaborative fashion, lateral power, sharing information. And now newspapers are either going out of business or trying to figure out how to create a blog. And certainly,
or just how to monetize, which they haven't been able to do.
That's
really.
Right. And Encyclopedia Britannica didn't anticipate Wikipedia. So what I'm suggesting is when internet communication technology, which is distributed and collaborative and lateral, actually starts to manage the energy, which is the basis of the economy, renewable energy, that's 1,000 times more powerful than the internet revolution alone. None of us have the answers to the new models, but I can give you a few examples of some of the new business models that are emerging, which seem counterproductive, but they actually allow you to make money. One is the utility companies. When we first laid this plan out in Europe, the power and utility companies weren't too happy. They said, we like to control the supply of energy. We like to control the transmission lines. We like to sell electrons. And you're telling us we can't do that. We began to break open the utility companies by introducing a new business model to them. We said, get used to it. In the future, millions of people are going to collect their own energy, just like they collect their own information. In the last 25 years, we've gone from centralized mainframe computers to desktop computers, and cell phones have become so cheap you can give them away. And we have 2.5 billion people now that can share their own information online with each other at the speed of light. The renewable energy technologies, Michael, are going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and eventually so cheap that they'll almost be free. The solar and wind and geothermal. And once that happens, the sun is free. The wind is free. The heat under your ground is free. So in the future, millions of people in their homes, offices, and factories will be producing their electricity and their energy. The power and utility companies will run the internet, the energy internet, because that's technical. And the way they make money is we use the IBM case study. You remember IBM in the 90s was making no money selling their physical computers because there was no margins. Everyone was selling the same computer. The Chinese were doing it, the Indians. So Lou Gerstner and IBM said, well, wait a minute, how do we make money in the future? And they decided their real expertise was managing information, not selling computers. So now every company has a chief information officer, and Hewlett-Packard and IBM and Cisco, they manage information. What we're saying to the utility companies, your new mission is your real expertise is not selling electrons, it's managing energy. So you will set up partnerships with thousands of corporate clients to manage their energy flows across their supply chain, embedded in their products, their logistics. And because the name of the game for the next 30 years for every business in the world is not labor cost, it's energy cost. Whether you swim or sink will depend on your energy margins. To the extent the utility companies can manage the energy flows of corporate clients, increase their thermodynamic efficiency, reduce their energy use across the supply chain, then the clients can share back their savings and their productivity and profit with the utility companies.
Well, this is going to disappoint some people who want to see the utility companies become obsolete or totally controlled by the power of the people again.
Well, you know what? They might become obsolete as new players come in, and I will predict to you that you're going to start to see municipalities and local regions retaking over their utility companies.
Los Angeles, for example, runs essentially. Let me go to more of your calls. And by the way, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. And let's bring in TJ from Mountain View. Good morning.
Hi, thanks very much for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm glad to hear this. It sounds also like what Amory Lovin has been saying for some years as well. Years back in 1988, I was living in Gainesville, Florida, and there was a Korean physicist who was doing superconducting research. He gave a talk, and one of the things he said, you know, look, if I succeed in this research and we have superconducting transmission lines with no power loss, we still have to talk about whether we centralize our power distribution and what that entails, mm-hmm. the risk from natural disasters that we've seen in Ohio from lightning strikes, as well as terrorist attacks. And it seems to me the one thing that we don't hear about when we talk about distributed power generation is it protects us from centralized power distribution and the weakness inherent from a terrorist attack or a natural disaster. When you've got the grid distributed, you've got power generating all over, knocking out one place, you're going to knock out 300,000 to 400,000 homes. Could you comment on that?
You're absolutely right. And, of course, remember the ARPANET, the Pentagon created the ARPANET, which was the basis of the internet, because exactly what you're saying they wanted a distributed system so that if there was some kind of a problem that could wipe out a centralized system, they could go back to a distributed system. And you're right. When everyone's producing their own energy, if there is some kind of terrorist attack or a centralized terrorist attack, you can go back to your distributed system. You want to build in all your buildings so they're passive already, so that they use as little energy as possible. And you can still maintain viable life in your local communities and regions on the microgrids. So from a security point of view, it makes sense. And the military, The Department of Defense, of course, is the biggest spender in the government on moving toward these third industrial revolution energies because they want them for logistics in the field. They don't want to rely on centralized command and control. They'd rather be able to produce their energy right in the field.
Let me read a few comments. This one is from Facebook. Ramin writes, "The problem with Mr. Rifkin's solution is that it is simply much too slow. By the time your five pillars is implemented, mankind shall have depleted and burned all the fossil fuel that is stored inside the earth and release it in the form of CO2. This simply cannot be allowed to happen. Therefore, the first step should be the complete halt of extraction of fossil fuels for the purpose of burning them. We need to stop the oil addiction. Cold turkey. Should the price of hydrocarbons suddenly skyrocket? Of course, that would be the point. Only at that point would there be sufficient will for serious change." And another listener, sort of adding on to this, Robert says, "Any discussion about sustainable energy future where wind, solar, and other green supply sources are emphasized, please don't overlook that energy efficiency should be at the front of the line. Too often energy efficiency gets short shrift. It should be number one pillar."
I agree with that. And we actually, when we do our master plans, we make it number one. It's the starting point. And in the book, we spend a lot of time on the efficiencies. You can't get to the five pillars until we get the thermodynamic efficiencies down. That means as we convert our buildings to power plants, we first have to retrofit them. We have to get the leaks out. We've got to make sure that they're energy tight. And that's where we begin to make a lot of savings. If we don't do that, if we don't do the energy efficiencies and increase the thermodynamic efficiencies of our existing infrastructure, we can't lay down these five pillars. So in our master plan workshops with the cities and regions, we always start with efficiencies. It's essential.
Where does entropy fit into this? You mentioned it before, and you're mentioning thermodynamics, and I'm thinking, you know, things are entropic. I mean,
well, they are.
They're winding down.
A CO2, climate change is the entropy bill. And not a metaphor. It's a literal entropy bill for the first and second industrial revolution. We burned lots of carbon, low entropy. And then the exhumed gases, high entropy, are clogging the atmosphere, and we're not getting enough of the sun's radiation off the planet. It's as simple and complex as that. Every civilization works off an energy curve. And in the early days, the energy communication mix allows you to reduce the cost, scale, and then eventually you plateau. And at the other end of that bell curve, you begin to pay the entropy bill for past economic activity. We're now at the downside of our bell curve for the second industrial revolution. The energies are more expensive. The entropy bill is building with climate change. And your listener is right. We're running out of time. But I would suggest not only do we have to find some way to tax the carbon, but it's absolutely essential that we also have a new economic paradigm moving quickly. And what I've noticed is around the world, in Europe and now in Asia, we're beginning to see this third industrial revolution roll out very, very quickly. Watch these countries. Watch Japan.
Actually, here's a listener who says, do we need new theories to take us beyond those of Adam Smith, Lord Keynes, M. Friedman, inter alia, about how the economy now global works? The notions of comparative advantage and the roles of fiscal and monetary policy have been critical to where we are. We appear to be at a point of inflection worldwide that cry out for some very different thinking, especially in light of the global economy under the auspices of still politically siloed governments. And if new breakthrough theories are called for, who is developing them? Once they're introduced, they take years to take hold. And here's sort of related to that is Gary, who writes, what do you think of all the small alternate fusion energy projects such as the Polywell, General Fusion, Lawrenceville, Tri-Alpha, Helion, et cetera? I think there's a good chance at least one will succeed and fundamentally change everything. So you got two different paradigms there.
This is the first listener that's called in on the question of do we need to change our economic theory. That's the longest chapter in this book. It's called Retiring Adam Smith. And, you know, I teach at the Wharton School. It's the oldest business school in the world. And I teach in the executive ed program, education program. And I've been there forever. And I have to say that engineers know more about economics than economists. The economics profession is not up to the task at this point of addressing this tremendous shift that's going to take place in the world. And the reason is,
forgive me, but it's still the dismal science, right?
Well, it is.
I mean, engineering is not a dismal science. It's a pretty clear-headed science.
It is. And I think the problem is when Adam Smith and the architects of our early economic theory were evolving their work, the rage at the time was Newtonian mechanics. So they used Newtonian metaphors to describe economic theory and practice. The problem is Newtonian mechanics doesn't tell you a damn thing about economics. Economics is based on the laws of energy, the thermodynamic laws, because economic activity is how we take energy and embedded energy in matter on the planet, transform it into goods, utilities, and then it goes back and has to be recycled. So what we need to do is rethink economic theory based on thermodynamics. not on Newtonian mechanics. And that changes everything. For example, gross domestic product is not a stock of wealth when you look at it thermodynamically. It's the temporary value in your goods and services at the expense of the energy and materials of the earth you've used and the entropy bill you create, and even that those things of value become part of that entropy bill eventually. So gross domestic product is your debt to nature. It's not a stock
of
wealth.
It's all the resources.
Right. And same with productivity. This is pretty interesting. There's been a little secret embarrassment within the economics profession about the nature of productivity. We've always believed you put more capital to labor and you get more productivity. And the reason is our economists had a fetish about capital because of capitalism, that capital must be the job, the engine. But unfortunately, 86% of productivity in the 20th century cannot be accounted for by capital to labor. What we're now learning is the other 86% of productivity was not capital. It's thermodynamic efficiencies that increases productivity. So, yes, I hope the listener will get a chance to read that chapter. We hope that we open up a new conversation within the economics profession. We've got to totally turn it around and rethink economic theory because it simply cannot address the issues that we're facing on this planet.
I want to get to more calls, but do you think there's the general fusion kind of thing is really part of the whole picture here, or should be? Lawrenceville, Tri-Alpha, Hellion, all these?
We've been hearing about fusion for years. I'm open to any kind of energy that comes along that's viable and sustainable with a low entropy bill. The bottom line is it's not here. And the real issue is this. We have enough energy on this planet till kingdom comes. 1 hour of sunlight can power the world for a year. We've got enough wind forever. We've got so much geothermal heat under the ground that we wouldn't have to count on it for hundreds of thousands of years. So the point is, these are the energies that bathe the planet, the winds, the geothermal heat, the ocean tides, the agricultural waste, garbage converted to energy. We can now collect them. And you know, Michael, you and I go back a long time. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, industry would say to me, Mr. Rifkin, how are you going to run the world on solar roofs and garbage and windmills? This seems quixotic, windmills. It's soft energy. It can't do the job. You need hard energy. And frankly, we couldn't answer that question 20 years ago. We knew that these energies are ample compared to non-renewables. But we can answer this issue now. It came to us here in California, in Silicon Valley, when researchers figured out how to connect hundreds of thousands of desktop computers with new software. And when you connect hundreds of thousands or millions of little teeny desktop computers with software, the distributed computing power dwarfs centralized supercomputers. We can now take this. It's called grid IT. It's the cutting edge of the IT industry. We can take grid IT now to power and transmission of electricity. When millions of players are collecting energy on site, storing it in hydrogen like digital and media, and what you don't need, the grid IT will allow us to share it across continents with far more potential energy than these little teeny nuclear and coal-fired power plants. But this energy has to move with the rhythms of the earth. So it can't move beyond the ability of nature to recycle and replenish the stock.
Our guest again is Jeremy Rifkin, his new book, The Third Industrial Revolution. Our next caller is Kyle. Good morning, Kyle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Could you comment if the scenarios and technologies you're describing intersect at all with this idea of the coming singularity?
Well, in the last chapter of the book, yes, I actually mentioned the singularity in Ray Kurzweil's work and others. What we're seeing here, again, and it gets back to the work issue, this five-pillar infrastructure that we're talking about is a mega technology to create a smart, intelligent, completely interconnected nervous system and energy system so that you can have seamless energy, communication, and transport, all connected intelligent systems around the world. Yes, it's going to require one big last surge of mass labor because it has to be put in. That means millions of jobs creating the renewable energies, millions of jobs converting the buildings to power plants, millions of jobs for the storage and hydrogen, millions of jobs to change the transmission lines, millions of jobs to create the logistics. But as we mature that infrastructure, we won't need those jobs because it'll be smart, intelligent, and we can run it with very boutique specialized workforces. So in the last chapter, I devote to where do we go from there? We're going to have to move more and more people into the civil society, the not-for-profit sector, which is the fastest growing employment sector in the world right now by far. And this is where you create social capital. So it's immune to technology displacement because humans are interacting with other humans. And in 42 countries that have been surveyed last year, this sector is the fastest growing. 51% of its income comes from fees for services. So I think by mid-century, if this all doesn't derail, and it may be that we won't make it in time, but if it doesn't derail, I imagine the marketplace made up of boutique workforces, the civil society made up of a lot of our employment, and people will then use their income to buy goods and services both in the not-for-profit sector and in the market sector as well.
But speaking of derailing, you may not be privy to any more information than the rest of us, but what do you suppose happened with Solyndra?
I don't know. I really have no more knowledge of Solyndra than you do, but I will say it may be that they were part of a larger problem again. President Obama did not tell a story. He wasted so much money in putting out special projects that were isolated, standalone. Let me explain the lessons we learned, because we made this mistake in Europe. This will be a good anecdote for why some of these projects are failing in the United States. Last year, the European Commission put out a memo saying, uh-oh, we need €1 trillion right now for this distributed energy internet. Why? European countries, Michael, put in feed-in tariffs. So your electricity price gets raised just a teeny bit. You don't even notice it. But then it allows early adopters to put renewable energies on their buildings. Well, now thousands and thousands of people are trying to put their electricity to the grid, but the grid is 60 years old, servo-mechanical, unidirectional, and it can't take the energies. So we didn't move on the energy internet fast enough to deal with the feed-in tariffs. Then we realized some of our regions now, because of feed-in tariffs, are 20, 30, 40% renewable energy in Europe, and we're losing 3 out of 4 kilowatts because we didn't put hydrogen to store these intermittent energies like the wind and the sun, so we have to put in the hydrogen. Then we realized we didn't incentivize the homeowners and the small and medium-sized businesses. The big companies can put in solar and wind, but what about the little guys? And we realize it's cost a lot of money, €25,000 to put a solar power plant on your roof. Finally, now Germany and Italy, the big banks, are coming together with startup companies. They're providing green loans. And listen to this. In Italy, you can get a green loan for a photovoltaic power plant on your roof. 60 days later, it's on your roof. And the reason the banks will give you a good loan at a low discount rate is they look at your electricity bill. And they realize you're going to save electricity and pay as you save. Only Ontario in all of North and South America has a feed-in tariff. Vermont just started. So it's the feed-in tariffs that allow us to move this, and the opportunities there are enormous. And what I would ask anyone that says we can't do this, where do we go then if we don't do this? How do we regrow the American economy? We certainly can't rely on the old energies, technologies, and infrastructure. They're not going to grow a damn thing for us in the 21st century.
We go to Oakland. Chris, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on.
Hi, gentlemen. Fascinating conversation. I was wondering if your guest could compare this historical moment to the one where Nikola Tesla envisioned wireless power transmission, and from what I can understand, maybe you can shed some light on it, was kind of shut down by the folks who said, how are we going to get paid to string all the transmission lines all over creation if we start transmitting power for free and you tune in your radio and run your whole kitchen? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you.
I'm glad you mentioned Tesla. I was going to put him in the book, but last minute we didn't. But it raises an interesting issue. What we're realizing now is that this third industrial revolution infrastructure can actually move more quickly in some of the developing world than in the developed world. And the reason is they don't have any infrastructure. 40% of the human race, as you know, makes under $2 a day, and 25% of the human race has never, ever had any electricity. None. And another 20% of the human race has marginal, occasional access to electricity. We didn't anticipate cell phones taking off in Africa. There was no electricity grid, nothing. And now all of a sudden, millions of people have cell phones. Then the power towers came in. What we're beginning to see in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, where there is very little infrastructure, communities can leapfrog in and actually start to put solar and wind and geothermal heat pumps on, and then on their buildings start to connect with each other, create small nodes, and then connect to the next node and the next node. And it's actually moving very quickly. It's like, do you want to renovate an old house? That's going to be a lot more money than building a new house from scratch, and it's going to take longer. So I think what we're beginning to see is the developing country, we're going to see this move very, very robustly because it gives them not only a new energy regime, but a new infrastructure for a third industrial revolution paradigm. Germany wants to stay ahead of the game. And so if Germany can do this in the developing world, it will send a message here to the States that we ought to be maybe at least taking a look at what Germany and Europe is doing.
Yeah, but then you have India and China who feel, you know, it's our time. We've got to plumb this fossil fuel energy and make – I know a lot is happening in China, certainly. But it's almost as if they're saying on some level – you know, we want a piece of this pie, and we economically we want to get ahead, and it's been your turn long enough. Now it's ours.
I can't speak to China, but I can speak to India. We're now working with the federal FICCI. It's the Federal Chamber of Commerce of India. It's all the 80,000 businesses, trade associations across India. They came to us about 10 months ago, and they asked my office, would you help us develop a collaborative master plan for Indian businesses to begin to transition into a third industrial revolution infrastructure. India is very democratic, very decentralized. So it fits for a distributed third industrial revolution infrastructure, especially because they rely on small and medium-sized enterprises across India. So I can't speak for China. We haven't had dealings with them. But watch India, watch Japan and the developing
world.
It's
heartening to hear about India, actually. It's exciting stuff. Third industrial revolution, how lateral power is transforming energy and changing the world. Jeremy Rifkin, thank you so much for joining us on Forum.
Thank you,
Always
Michael.
Good to have you. And again, he'll be at the Commonwealth Club at noon today and then at Booksmith tomorrow in San Francisco at 7:30 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with Andy Borowitz in this hour, and actually Francis Collins in the first hour, the head of National Institutes of Health. Hope you would join us. Thank you for joining us. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing forum@kqed.org or going to Facebook or our website, kqed.org/forum. You can continue this conversation there on our website. Thank you for being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.